From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Christine Colson, whose new novel about the Metropolitan Museum of Art is Metropolitan Stories, published by The Other Press. Christine Colson began her career at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1991 as a summer intern in the European Paintings Department. She returned in 1994 and over the next 25 years rose through the ranks of the museum, working in the Development Office, the Director's Office, and the Department of European Sculpture and Decorative Arts. In 2019, she left the Met to write full-time. Here's a little information about her new novel. Hidden behind the Picassos and Vermeers, the Temple of Dendur and the American Wing, exists another world. The hallways and offices, conservation studios, storerooms, and cafeteria that are home to the museum's devoted and peculiar staff of 2,200 people, along with a few ghosts. A surreal love letter to this private side of the Met, Metropolitan Stories unfolds in a series of vignettes which we discover larger-than-life characters, the downside of survival, and the powerful voices of the art itself. I began my interview with Christine Colson by asking her to read a scene from Metropolitan Stories. This part of the narrative is told from the point of view of a museum conservator. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
In a gallery of monumental Buddhas, we guide the famous photographer's team to our anonymous locked door. We climb two stories up an industrial staircase where a gray corridor leads them to our studio, glowing at the end of the hallway. Disturbing our hush, the famous photographer's team declares the space so authentic and perfect just as it is. Then they request changes. Light meters and unwelcome curiosity poke into our intimate world. They measure as if planning to redecorate, move in. They return the day of the photo shoot, hours before the famous photographer or the gift man, and set up on one end of our long room. We imagine their piles of equipment tipping the whole space on its side. We are pulled from our work and brought into the foreign buzz of these fast-moving creatures. Four masterworks from the gift man's collection are arranged for the camera. Old-fashioned hang cranks clamp the pictures into place on 7-foot-high wooden easels. Wheels make the easels mobile, but vulnerable to the team's frenetic movements. Lights are organized and test shots taken, while the famous photographer judges from some unknown off-site location. We watch, saucer-eyed, as one among the team, a fit Viking with long hair and facial scruff, plants his feet where the gift man will eventually stand. The Viking turns his eyes to the camera like an aspiring underwear model, narrowing them with shameless conceit. We look on, dumbstruck by his lack of self-consciousness. Our lives are devoted to our absence, to the idea that no trace of ourselves should be left in our work. We have succeeded only if our interventions, new varnish, retouching, repairs, are not just invisible, but reversible, able to be completely erased, wiped away by future generations. The famous photographer arrives hours later, good-humored and ready. Her team swirls around her, enthusing about the light and the exclusive location. She plays the cool older mom, chatting amicably with us in a practice style meant to be both friendly and aloof. She understands her star power and shows little care for the inconvenience she has caused. But the gift man understands timing. He will not be denied his entrance. He arrives just late enough to ensure that we are all waiting for him and enters the studio to a ripple of applause. He is then positioned near his paintings on the mark where the Viking preened. The famous photographer cheers and hugs the gift man like this is the opportunity of a lifetime. Oh, gift man, she coos from behind the camera. I've got to tell you, there is nowhere else I can imagine being than in this room at this moment with you and these paintings. She stresses the you over these paintings, stroking his ego in a way that she hopes will show up on film. The gift man responds in his trademark vaudevillian style. Hey, lady, everyone here is in the same business. We make things look good. He grins with a winking, complicit smile. I know the drill, he continues. Shoulders back, tits out. As he shouts the words, he snaps into the pose of kings and generals. It is as if a wind machine has been switched on, pushing against his deflated cheeks and whipping his remaining strands of hair. Oh, you're such a pro, GIF man, the famous photographer cajoles. The GIF man knows his tits line will warm up the room and send us all home with a story. And isn't that the goal of it all, really? Sending us home with a story about him? Not just here in this room, but out there in the world forever. And oh, do we tell the tale of this day again and again for years. It is birthday cake and lollipops every time. We make it bigger and louder with each repeating, embellishing it, inflating it, and the GIF man until it almost bursts.
Great. Thank you so much for reading that. I love that section. I'm like 90% sure I know who the famous photographer is.
Most people feel the same way about the GIF man.
And the GIF man. Right. So the GIF man, we should explain, because it's explained earlier in the chapter that he's a patron and he's giving these paintings to the museum. But I think one thing that I loved so much about that section is this wonderful juxtaposition of the conservator's point of view. That's the narrator in that is a conservator at the museum. Mm-hmm. And this line that their lives are devoted to the absence, to the idea that no trace of themselves should be left in their work. And there's just this incredible juxtaposition with the kind of vanity and high degree of self-aggrandizement of so many others in this world. And I thought that really stood out. So I thought I would start there.
Yeah, and I think there is a kind of underlying storyline in the book about that. I mean, I'm really talking about almost two collections. There's the works of art, which I give human agency to.
Yes.
But then there is the staff, and they are kind of exquisite works of art unto themselves. And one of the things I really wanted to bring forward are those kind of quiet heroes who are behind the scenes, and whether they're conservators who are incredibly trained and talented and sensitive to those works of art and have an intimacy with them that no one else does, or even the guys who change the light bulbs and the custodians who sweep the galleries. I think there is this sense of the unseen and the unsung, who I really wanted to shine a light on.
Yeah. Yeah, and in some ways, literally shining a light on.
Literally, yes.
Or turning the lights off.
Yeah. And I think that's, the difference of working there versus visiting is that you become a part of that in a way that's really important. And people visit the Met once in a while or sometimes once in a lifetime, but I lived there for 25 years, and so those people became a kind of community and a family with all those same dynamics that one can imagine in a group of people devoted to the same thing but with all their peculiar characteristics coming into play. And so I think that time and that more extended way of looking at things allows you to kind of relax in that place that most people find very intimidating. And I think my point of view greatly changed because of that experience. And much of what I write about and was compelled to write about is that world, which sits right next to that much glossier space.
Yeah, I thought that was all really clear. Before we go much further, I would love it if you could talk a little bit about your own background with the Metropolitan Museum of Art and explain, like, what jobs did you hold over those years?
Mm-hmm. I'm unusual because I held different positions throughout my time there. I started as an intern there in 1991 and probably had the best job I'll ever have, I was in the European Paintings Department, and I was given the assignment of sorting through the correspondence between the great American Impressionist painter Mary Cassatt and the amazing late 19th century collector Louisine Havemeyer. They had a very constant correspondence, and the Met had been given a box of their letters, and my job was to sort through these beautiful little folded pieces of paper with their sealing wax and read the letters and kind of categorize them. So when the curator wanted to write, he would know what the content of each letter was. So I was kind of cataloging them. Because I needed space, I was given this beautiful office of a very senior curator who was on sabbatical.
Oh, wow.
And so I just thought, you know, sign me up. This is a great gig. And ironically, I then went off to graduate school, got my degree in art history, and came back to the Met and got a job as a development assistant, a job that was really a classic assistant, coffee getting, phone answering, mail delivering. I wrote exhibition descriptions. And at that point, it was almost the exact reverse. I was, you know, I sat on a stool, literally. I had no desk. But at the same time, you know, it was a completely analog world. So this is 1994, and I'm in this place that's still, you know, writing with carbon paper, and it's all very real time. And so one of my jobs at that point was to deliver what we call cheeses at the Met.
Yeah, that was great.
Interdepartmental office envelopes the rest of the world has, that are yellow and they have holes in them. And at the Met, as far as I know, only at the Met do we call them cheeses. And you can, it's a verb, it's a noun, you can cheese someone a cheese. And I delivered cheeses because, unlike now when you can do everything on email, I would need to get, you know, everything was very rigged. There were permissions and approvals, and you'd have to get signatures from people. And so I did a lot of that. I would go to see these incredibly intimidating, larger-than-life figures who were running the museum then. I would wait for them to sign these documents, and then I would bring them back. And why that is interesting, I think, is because it really allowed me to truly own the physical museum. Mm-hmm. You know, all those corridors behind the galleries, sort of stairways that go up and down. It's a very complicated, 4-block-long, 2-block-deep.
Wow.
Building. And so that's what really gave me my cred, that I had done that very kind of physical work. And it gave me proximity to these people who, I think now if you're an assistant, you kind of read the emails, but you don't have that proximity to those characters. And so for me, it's very easy to evoke that time. And this book very much is about those first 10 years when I'm very young and wide-eyed. And those people are so intriguing. And I really do, I want in.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I've found my people, and I'm, you know, I've got lots of ambition and lots of misinformation, and, you know, I'm armed with that and delivering my cheeses. So that, to me, that very fundamental experience in those early years is what allowed me later, when I became a more senior person. You know, I worked in the director's office as a speechwriter for 8 years, and when I had that more senior role, my credibility, I think, always came from those early years of doing that much more mundane work. And the time I had spent at the museum with those colleagues, we've all had grown up together. We had that connective tissue that comes from making mistakes and being together at times of great triumph and great peril. And so I think when difficult decisions had to be made later, when I was in a more senior role, that foundation was in place. So we had a kind of sibling-like trust.
Yeah. I loved at the end, toward the end of the book, you have a chapter, I won't go into it, but you mention how much respect people get for having a full career at the Met and spending, like, you know, starting as, you know, maybe in their teens or 20s and going all the way through their career there. And it's because it's such an amazing place, apart from the experience of being there, there must be very little turnover, right?
In certain places, and certainly in my generation, you came and you stayed.
Yeah.
And there was, I mean, part of it is it's very hard to know where to go.
Yeah.
You know, it's working at such a level that is really not replicable anywhere else. You could go be a bigger fish in a smaller pond, but you get quite addicted to the complexity and the pace and the standards.
Yeah.
So people generally didn't leave. And I liked that. I mean, I think, you know, there's another through line through the book, which is, and it's the opening to the book, this idea that we, the staff, think we're protecting and saving the art, but in fact, the art is very much protecting and saving us. So I always imagine that the people who stay, people like me and my colleagues who, you know, 25 years is actually a lot, but it's in Met time, you know, I was working with people who had been there for 40 and 50 years.
Right.
But that sense of dependency upon the place and the objects and the way in which we needed to stay because, and in my case, I definitely feel this, I'm very soothed by those objects. I mean, it's very, the museum is the closest thing I have to religion in the sense that that sense of survival and memory that's within those galleries is very important to me in gaining perspective and connection to the world we live in. And if you know, to me, that's what religion is in some ways. It's both kind of community and understanding.
And, you know, speaking of the objects that you just mentioned, I had you read a fairly realistic piece from within the book, but there is this wonderful magic in the book, too, where mm-hmm. you personify objects and they get narrative points of view. Like the small chair, throne chair made for an 18th century duchess, other objects and paintings and sketches. And
Adam, yeah.
Yeah, Adam. So I wonder if you can talk about this, about sort of empathizing with the experience of being an object removed from life and put on display, essentially. I thought that was wonderful,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, and I think there's a real, again, I think that comes from a kind of more relaxed looking that you're able to sort of feel that point of view, and I would encourage people to visit any museum. I mean, this book is very much about the Met, it's also about the world of the imagination, and I think that that idea of looking at objects in that way and thinking about what they have seen, what memories that object carries, what they have witnessed, is an interesting way to look at any historical object.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Adam is a Renaissance, early Renaissance marble statue. One of the great tragedies of my time at the Met was in 2002 when this particular statue fell off of its pedestal and broke into thousands of pieces.
Mm.
And it was like a death. I mean, our charge is only to keep these objects safe. And so when that was violated in this way, and through no one's fault, it was a great tragedy.
So the pedestal just gave way? Is that?
The pedestal gave way.
Yeah.
And, I'm not sure anyone will understand why, but my thought at that moment, after the kind of initial horror passed, was kind of, what did it feel like when Adam was in the air?
Yeah.
that idea of, like, not when it crashed to the ground, but that moment when it was just released from this static state that it had occupied for 500 years. Like, was that a little liberating? Maybe that moment of just, whee, here we go. And so one of the first things I ever wrote was that paragraph about that moment in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed writing about that, but thought there was something to that, and it became something that fed a larger narrative about, well, you know, how would he wind up in that position, and maybe he'd wanted to move for a long time, and
yeah.
I think that that idea of slowing things down and thinking about what those 500 years saw. So you have this statue who stands there and kind of witnesses, you know, people in costumes that we don't see anymore. So panniers and men in tights. And, you know, then, you know, you fast forward and it's the statue's witnessing someone on their cell phone. That span is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
There's a line early in the book about, you know, an object from an Egyptian tomb, that object saw the tomb door close on that first moment when it was put there. And we discover it 4,000 years later. But I'm interested in that reversal.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a wonderful, there's this wonderful little short piece toward the end of the book where you kind of investigate, you know, who's watching whom, who's protecting whom, you know, who has ownership over whom. I don't know that that's part of it, but that occurred to me at the time. You know, it's like we find this 4,000-year-old object and we suddenly think it's ours, but that's ridiculous, you know?
Yes. And the idea that, you know, there's kind of a downside of survival.
Yeah.
This idea that anyone or any person who has taken care of that object, looked at that object, studied that object, eventually they disappear. And that the objects themselves are the evidence that's left behind that anyone ever existed at all.
Yeah. Now, at some point you mentioned that you worked on this book for, is it 12 years you worked on this book?
Oh, no. 12 months.
Oh, 12 months.
I thought about it for 23 years.
Okay.
And then the Met gave me a sabbatical for a year in 2017, and I had exactly a year to write it. So I sat down on January 2nd, and it really just came pouring out of me, mainly because I think it had a 23-year cooking time.
Yeah.
I didn't write a word during that time. I didn't take notes or keep a journal. It was all kind of in my head.
Oh, wow.
And so it was an amazing experience. And I literally finished it to the day in a year.
Wow. And then you had to find a publisher, and then you probably revised it after that. And was that just a draft?
Yeah, that whole other process, once it was bought, of then revisiting it. And I had a very interesting experience with that, and one I loved, actually. Other Press is run by Judith Gerovic, and she edits orally.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
wow.
I read my book to her over the phone.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Over the course of about 14 days, I would call in at the assigned time and read a chapter to her. And so we were editing in real time, and so I would say a line of dialogue, and she'd say, "I don't think he'd say that." And I'd say, "Well, he just did." And she said, the character you introduced me to wouldn't say that. And so I think most writers, you kind of, I liked the real-time dialogue of that, but she had a very nice way of then also saying, "Just look at it. Just look at it." And so I was doing the marking up on my end of the phone, sort of marking passages to revisit. Moments of, you know, when you're going to use magic and you're going, and I don't love that word, but if you are going to kind of introduce that surrealist quality and objects are going to have to agency, you need an incredible amount of clarity around that so that readers are willing to take that flight with you.
Okay.
And so one of the great things that she did is sort of really work with me on creating that solid foundation so that we couldn't, you know, have those flights of the imagination, and people would feel like they, everything was stable enough to be able to follow the passage. And so there was often times when I would be reading and she'd say, wait, no, I'm lost here. And instead of having a note in the margin that said, you know, just lost here, you know, I would be able to ask back to her, you know, are you emotionally lost, psychologically lost?
Right.
You know, geographically lost? And she said, yeah. I mean, are we still in the basement? Said, yeah. And she said, well, I just need that more clear. And so that kind of back and forth about really drilling down to what the issue was really satisfying. And I can tell you, I then took the manuscript back and for 2 months really dove into it and was addressing her comments. She was never wrong,
wow.
Ever.
That's amazing. I've never heard of anybody who works like that. That's pretty unusual,
I know.
Right?
She's extraordinary. And I think if you're game for it, it's a really great thing. I can see why some people don't like it. I didn't mind it at all. I liked that connection of going back and forth, and she really knew how to, she has an ear more than she has, more than an editorial eye.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I mean, it makes so much sense because there are people that do have more of an ear and are going to get more out of listening. I mean, so many people are listening to books these days, and that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And we, as writers, constantly read aloud to find where things stumble a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I do. I mean, I always read my own stuff out loud. Yeah. It just, maybe it's a speech writing tick.
I think that's I've gotten that advice before and I do it all the time. I wonder, Christine, if you can talk a little bit, you already mentioned this, but I loved this description of the tunnels of the Met. You describe them as the grim bowels below the basement where storage cages made with woven metal fencing held retired art and cartons of old paperwork. And then there's this wonderful journey that somebody takes down there. But just, I wonder if you can talk about being down there. Did you spend time in the museum after hours often?
Well, yes. I mean, we were very devoted employees. And again, maybe because we didn't have much of a social life being in one another. But I spent so much time in that museum by myself in those galleries, early in the morning, late at night, when all you hear are your own footsteps on those marble floors. I mean, and that's when, again, it's a totally different atmosphere, a different experience of those objects. And the tunnels were a real ritual. And I write a lot about ritual in this book because I think most cultures, like the museums, have these kinds of traditions and rituals and peculiar rhythms. Mm-hmm. And one of ours was that we would go to the tunnels every year. The tunnels are actually water tunnels. It used to be that where the big New York Public Library is down on 42nd Street, behind that was what was called the Croton Reservoir. Mm-hmm. And so that was a reservoir with water, and the water traveled through these, what are now we call the tunnels. That reservoir is now at Bryant Park, and that has all been shut down, but we use those tunnels, again, back in the analog days, to store old files. Mm-hmm. And so once a year, we would go down to the tunnels and deliver and shove these boxes of files, and they're still probably there, into these what were called cages. And different departments had their cages. And so there were odd objects. There's no art in the tunnels. It's all this kind of old, dusty stuff, pieces of architecture, little bits of statuary that wasn't quite right or wasn't quite real, and so there's both a timeless quality to the tunnels in that you feel like this could be the 19th century, but also something a little creepy about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I did want to write about the tunnels. I really had that in my head as something I wanted to do, but I hadn't been to the tunnels in about 10 years. So I had someone take me down to the tunnels to find the story I would write there.
Nice.
And so, yes, as you suggested, it's a wild ride in the tunnels. And
that section reminded me a tiny bit of From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler.
Absolutely.
Remember that book?
Yes, and this book is very much for the generation who enjoyed that book.
Yeah.
It has that same sense of mystery and discovery. I just felt, anything could be in the tunnels, and the tunnels could go anywhere.
Right.
And so why not ride that wave?
Yeah.
So it was fun to write that chapter.
Now, this book is absolutely nothing like the book I'm about to mention, but there is some Devil Wears Prada to some of these people and their interactions. And it made me wonder how real are the characters you were drawing on, and how much did you have to camouflage certain relationships?
Well, it's funny because I often joke that I think the publishing world would have been happier. I think they wanted me to write the Devil Wears Prada Museum Edition. and I think, or a memoir. And I didn't feel like I could do that, mainly because what I wanted to write about was that other thing, that more magical quality. I wanted to capture what I feel is in that place. And I couldn't do that in a straight way. the characters themselves, you know, they are very much fiction. And while they have the traits in the beginning of someone, often, you know, so I'll think of somebody, they really took off on their own, which almost mm-hmm. surprised me sometimes. But they did, you know, they get their own legs. And I found that the ones that didn't do that, I got rid of. Because okay. that kind of straight portrait or caricature of someone wasn't interesting and couldn't hold up to the magic of the art. So the characters had to be really strong in order to kind of work within this world that I had created. So a kind of just straight satire was, I don't know, it didn't hold up for me.
Yeah.
You know, someone like the director in chapter 3, you're introduced to the director of the Met.
Yeah.
And that character, to the extent that he is the French director of the Met, who is both feared and adored, is certainly based on the legendary director of the Met, Philippe de Montebello. He was director there for 31 years, and the book is dedicated to him. The time in this book is very much his museum.
Okay.
He was someone who embodied the institution in a way that no one else ever has. So, yes, that is, you know, in terms of introducing that character, I felt like I had to use that strength and that iconic quality. But then when I get into what he's thinking and feeling and mm-hmm. the complexity of a real character, I mean, I can tell you that Philippe de Montebello and I didn't have intimate conversations about what he was feeling. He was my hero, but, you know, at that point you have to write it and you have to let the character do its thing.
It's funny because as I was, even from the point of view of a very young woman who is totally intimidated, he never comes across as an ogre. He only comes across as somebody who she feels very impressed by and also mm-hmm. like concerned that she doesn't know what might come next. But there's never a sense that something terrible has come before.
Right, yeah. Right. And that I think that aligns with the character I wanted to write. It certainly aligns with my sensibility in that time. You know, I think there's really something, there's something to writing from the perspective of someone who doesn't know everything.
Yeah.
And using that point of view and lack of understanding to develop what something looks like, and what something, you know, feels like,
yeah.
When you don't have all the pieces.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm curious how the museum has reacted to the book. Are they publicizing it? Are they putting it in their bookstore?
Oh, yeah, they're very supportive.
Oh,
they're
that's
very
wonderful.
Supportive. I think they, you know, they gave me this sabbatical to write the book. They were very supportive of it. One of the things I really had to do in writing it was to physically leave that place and make sure I wasn't writing a book for them or for the staff, my colleagues. That would have, you know, it could have been a very amusing book for the 2,200 people who work there. But I needed to write a book for everyone.
Right.
And so detaching myself from the very extensive training I had at that museum, if I were writing this book for the Met, I would have included an object from each of the 17 curatorial departments.
Yeah.
That's the way I was trained. And so what you wind up with in the book now are the objects that really speak to me. They are sort of my personal list of works of art that I go to and find both comfort and inspiration in. But they're not anyone's greatest hits. I mean, they're not, these aren't masterpieces for the most part. So I think that it was really important for me as a writer to kind of remove myself from the culture that was inspiring this book so that I would kind of detach myself a little bit and have the liberty to really write and to tell the story I wanted to tell. But at the same time, my devotion to the institution, you know, it's a love letter to that
yeah.
place and its possibilities.
Yeah.
And I think they never questioned my loyalty and whether I would write anything other than that. So I didn't show it to anyone before it was published. I gave Philippe de Montebello the first copy because it was dedicated to him.
Uh-huh.
And And, you know, it's become in the last 2 weeks since it has been released, a kind of parlor game at the museum to try and figure out who's who. and it's a, you know, it's a futile task because so many of the characters are conflated and changed. And,
yeah.
But there is a lot of authentic detail in there. And I was very rigorous about the location of objects, the location of galleries, the collection itself. I never say we have something we don't have.
Right.
I felt like that authenticity to the details also laid the foundation for the more magical parts. I think you needed that stability. I think people like that. I was very committed to the texture of those kinds of little, that little minutia, I think is important.
I think it also helps you carry off your ending, which I am not going to say a word about, but I accept that I really loved it. Let's see.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, and I really was, you know, one of the things that I felt was really important is that while it is 16 vignettes told from different points of view, it is a novel because you need to read them in the order in which I crafted them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just dive into chapter 11 and just read that. The aggregated knowledge that you get as you read and the repetition of characters and the way things you learned in chapter 2 loop back in chapter 7, that structure was very important to me and one of the things I worked hardest at so that when you got to that last chapter and what happens there, you were fully prepared to believe that.
Right.
And I think, you know, I used to walk around with this little foam core board that had these sticky notes on it that where I had written in Sharpie the sort of details of each chapter and how they would work and sort of diagramming it to try and figure out what the best kind of architecture was for crafting the whole arc of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, and it was one of the biggest challenges.
And was that something that your editor helped you with when you were going through those sort of oral sessions?
You know, by the time I'd sold the book, that structure was in place.
It was in place,
so
okay.
It didn't change, yeah.
Okay. Now, you write at one point about the strange cocktail of confident superiority and tolerated eccentricity that exists at the museum. Those are your words, and I liked that.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, how much is that about New York, and how much is it specific to the Met?
Probably a combination of both, but I think there's a funny loop in a place like the Met where the standards are so high,
right?
That's peculiar to that place.
Mm-hmm.
There is an arrogance to that. That's not the Met way. We don't do it that way. Those are words often used in that institution, and so there's that, and you get to stay. And so you kind of have that reflected quality of like, I'm in this place that holds these standards and I'm allowed and indeed encouraged to stay. So I'm drinking that Kool-Aid.
Right.
But at the same time, the people who they want to stay and who do wind up staying are usually, you know, we were an odd bunch, maybe because we needed that bigger thing. We wanted to be part of that bigger whole. Curators are amazing scholars and extraordinary people with the most finely tuned set of eyes that one can imagine, but they're not always easy and they can be incredibly difficult. And passionate about what they do. And to me, that's what you tolerate to get the, you know, I often use the analogy that the curators and the conservators are like the dancers at the ballet.
Mm.
Like it's non-negotiable. Everything we do feeds into their success because we can't do it without them. Right. I was easily replaceable. The guy in accounting, you can get another person to do that. What they do, that's exceptional.
Yeah.
And so with that come these very outsized personalities and, you know, not always the most well-adjusted human beings. And we're all there in this like, you know, the Met functions like a small town. You know, it's big enough to feel that way.
Yeah.
You've got 2,200 people. You've got, you know, your own police force with 900 guards. you've got shops and restaurants and a mayor, and we're all there, and there's this kind of dynamic that exists in there, along with those very anonymous people. Like in the final chapter of the book, I write about a staff member whose name we don't even know,
right,
but who his job, which is one of many obscure jobs at the Met, is to organize the shopping bags for the Met stores. And so those, you know, little red ones and the medium blue ones and the big yellow ones, those iconic bags, are organized by this little anonymous creature who no one ever sees except in the same spot in the basement all the time.
Yeah.
And so that spectrum of characters, from the director who embodies the museum and all that it stands for, to this anonymous person who diligently and devotedly does this very mundane task, I think really sums up the kind of characters that exist there. And this shared devotion to the bigger thing, I think, is what makes it kind of that shared eccentricity and that tolerance exist within those very, very high standards.
Okay. Christine, I always like to ask my guests if they're reading anyone else's work lately that they would recommend to listeners. Do you have any titles that you might recommend?
You know, I'm all about really tight writing.
Okay.
I really worked hard of that with my own cutting my own words very diligently. I love to write like a gardener. I like to prune.
Uh-huh.
And one of the most successful books I've read that is like that is Lily Tuck wrote a book called Sisters.
Okay.
It's a beautiful little volume, and it's kind of a one sitting kind of book. And some pages only have two sentences on them. And it is so tight and exquisitely wrought, and you know these characters, and you understand this plot line and everything you need to know about it, and then it's over. And I just think it is one of the most finely constructed works of fiction I've read in a really long time.
Oh, great.
The sisters are not sisters. They are women who are married to the same man, so one is a first wife and one is a second wife.
Oh, interesting.
So,
yeah,
it's a really, I really respect that the craftsmanship in that book.
Okay, wonderful. What are you writing lately?
You know, I'm working on the next one. I'm writing another novel, and it is, without giving it away, it is a single sentence in this book made into a novel.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So I got a little spark about a year ago, and again, didn't really address it, just thought about it, and it was persistent. And so I actually left the Met last April to work on this new book. I got to the point where I had gone back to the Met after my sabbatical, and I was working on an amazing project writing for the new British galleries that will open in March of 2020.
Yeah.
Hugely satisfying, but this little lingering idea kept poking its head, and I just got to the point last spring where I felt like every word I was writing for the Met was maybe a word I could be writing for me.
Yeah.
And I knew it was time. It was, in that way, it wasn't sad at all. I'm still at the museum all the time, but I'm really able to embrace this, this new, way of looking at it and writing about it. So I'm excited to flesh this one out. I've got a new foam core board and new sticky notes.
Isn't that the best?
I'm in that early, really romantic stage of enjoying what it could be, and you know, and also not writing. I like keeping it. Obviously, I kept the first one in my head for 23 years, so hopefully it won't take that long. But I really believe in withholding, in not writing, and letting things stew a little bit.
Well, that's interesting.
I think that can be really productive. So, I'm in the moment of sticky notes in Sharpie, but not putting anything to the page yet.
I think too, and maybe you'll agree with this, that, you know, writing for speeches or for publicity or that kind of work, it's really good at helping you become an excellent writer and as you say, like a tight writer. But it's different than the kind of work you do creatively to write a novel, and it could be a little bit better not to be trying to do both simultaneously. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was never someone who could do both. I can't sort of write one way all day and then come home at night and release this other way of thinking. I think one of the great privileges of having a sabbatical is that I could really, you know, steep myself in this whole world I was creating. And I just recognize that I need that as a writer. I need to be able to do that. I think you're right that the thing you learn with speech writing more than anything is structure. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, particularly that, the last chapter, of this book was one of the earliest chapters I wrote. And I think that comes from, speech writing is very similar to that. You know, you know where you need to go. You just don't always know what path you're going to take to get there.
Right.
And so that structural sense of how to build that, how to form a sort of satisfying trajectory to get to that, that bigger point. I think that is a great skill to have, and that way of thinking is really important.
Yeah, right.
And that ability to prune, I think, is really important. I got rid of I have a whole folder of pages and pages of things that I had written, that someday I'll go back and read, but, just to keep everything as tight as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think that's, you know, it's good to keep that in mind, be a little humble about your own writing, even if it's beautifully written. Sometimes you have to get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. I just have one last question for you, Christine. I find that the more important a person or a place or an event is to me, the harder it is to convey in a way. And I'm guessing the Met is exceptionally important to you, given the number of years you worked there and the amount of knowledge that you gathered about the history and the works. So I'm curious, I like to end with asking for advice for writers. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for writing about something that means a great deal to you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that's why I needed the magic, is to
interesting.
Create that sort of outsized sense of what it means to me.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I could do it with literal interpretation.
Right.
Magic allows you to inflate that affection in a way. I mean, it's why I was able to, you know, give the objects their own lives and their own points of view and their own voice.
Yes.
And so I think maybe sometimes reversing that is helpful. You know, people should challenge themselves to think about writing from the perspective of an inanimate object. I think that allowed me to really give strength to these works of art that I felt carried their own story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful advice. Okay, great. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Metropolitan Stories, a novel by Christine Colson, published by The Other Press. Christine, thank you so much for speaking with me. It was wonderful.
Thank you. It was delightful.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author, Christine Colson. You can learn more about her work at her publisher's website, otherpress.com. So this week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Christine Colson, and in fact, it has three parts to it, or there are three actual prompts that I thought of after speaking to Christine, one of which was something she specifically suggested in the end of the interview. But anyway, first of all, challenge yourself this week to write from the perspective of an inanimate object. Animate it. Think about how it might feel if it could express thoughts about its current situation. Second, rather than exchanging work on the page, try sharing your writing with a friend who acts as an editor for you by reading aloud from your work and letting that person offer suggestions after hearing it. This is how Christine Colson worked with her editor at the Other Press. And it is, in fact, actually how certain writing groups work together. I had just never heard of an editor doing that before, so it's kind of interesting. And then finally, imagine yourself in a famous museum or other historical building after hours. What would you do? And how would you feel? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and that's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. Look for that labeled tab at the top of my homepage. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and, of course, talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.